charging the Chinese with cyber spying. Today, Monday, May 19th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. Justice Department charges five Chinese military officials. The allegation?
The alleged hacking appears to have been conducted for no other reason than to advantage state-owned companies and other interests in China at the expense of businesses here in the United States.
But why now?
Chinese behave in a way that's not the way other countries behave, and we want them to play by the rules.
And later we speak with a Syrian colleague at the BBC who's unsure about returning to Homs, where his family is from.
I'm trying to draw a map of the city in my mind, and I just can't. I just see all this destruction. I mean, most of the city has been flattened.
Plus, remembering the Formula One legend who once pushed his car across the finish line.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo, recording up to six shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube, all on the TiVo Romeo DVR, TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Are you in the middle of finals, cramming for tests right now? Too much work, not enough time, too much caffeine, not enough sleep?
If any students are listening and complaining at this time of year that they have to study so hard for their exams, just spare a thought for the students of your MOOC who will take these kind of risks to ensure that they don't miss these crucial tests.
Later on the program, we'll find out what those students are risking just trying to take a test in the middle of Syria's civil war. Let's start, though, with the extraordinary news today involving the U.S. and China. You know, the relationship between Washington and Beijing is often all about nuance and diplomacy. Not today. Today, it's in your face in the form of a federal indictment. In an unprecedented move, the U.S. Justice Department has charged five members of China's military with cyber espionage. The indictment says they've stolen trade secrets from American companies. Attorney General Eric Holder said these are the first charges of this kind against a state actor. The World's Matthew Bell has details.
The indictment names five Chinese military officers with the People's Liberation Army, all of them members of Unit 61398, which U.S. officials say conducts extensive cyber espionage. Attorney General Holder said the suspects broke into private computer networks to steal trade secrets and internal communications from American companies.
The alleged hacking appears to have been conducted for no other reason than to advantage state-owned companies and other interests in China at the expense of businesses here in the United States. This is a tactic that the United States government categorically denounces.
The indictment names six U.S. companies as targets, including Westinghouse, U.S. Steel, and Solar World. China's foreign ministry issued a statement saying the U.S. charges are made up and demanding they be rescinded. But James Lewis of the Center on Strategic and International Studies says China can't be surprised. U.S. officials all the way up to President Obama have been raising this issue with their Chinese counterparts in meetings. Lewis says he was present at one such meeting about 2 years ago where the Americans presented a paper about Chinese hacking activities overseen by the People's Liberation Army.
And a Chinese PLA colonel responded by saying, look, in the U.S., military espionage is heroic, and economic espionage is a crime, but in China, the line is not so clear. Now, I think that sort of encapsulates the whole thing, is that the Chinese behave in a way that's not the way other countries behave, and we want them to play by the rules.
The Justice Department suggests that Chinese cybercrime undermines the free market and hurts American jobs. Lewis says there's a consensus on the extent of the problem among U.S. officials.
An internal study showed that Chinese economic espionage dwarfed all other countries, including Russia. So they are the most active. Last year, the FBI notified 3,000 U.S. companies that they'd been hacked. It's simply amazing.
3,000, by the way, works out to eight companies hacked every day. The FBI has added photos of the five wanted men to its website. Two of them are pictured in their Chinese military uniforms. They're being charged on 31 counts, each carrying possible penalties of 2 to 15 years in prison. In responding to U.S. allegations, the Chinese government points to revelations about cyber spying by the National Security Agency and says it's actually China that's a victim of U.S. surveillance and cyber theft. But James Lewis says that does not undermine the U.S. government's case against Chinese hacking.
if there was evidence that the NSA stole information to help U.S. companies, don't you think it would have been leaked by now? There is no such evidence. The second reason is the U.S. has always been really open with China. Espionage is a two-way street. We know great powers engage in espionage. What we object to is commercial espionage.
It would be unthinkable for China to extradite members of its military for prosecution in U.S. courts, but today's charges do raise the stakes on a contentious issue between Washington and Beijing. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
The president of South Korea made news today, taking responsibility for that ferry disaster last month, the one that killed some 300 people, mostly high school students. President Park Geun-hye went on national TV to apologize, tears rolling down her face. But then she turned on the country's Coast Guard, vowing to dismantle it.
119에 신고하고도 정작 본인은 돌아오지 못한 고 최덕하군.
President Park has been facing mounting criticism for how her government responded to that ferry disaster, and she seems to be passing the blame onto Korea's Coast Guard. Reporter Jason Strother in Seoul followed the president's announcement today. Just help us understand, first of all, Jason, this overflow of emotion from President Park.
Right, Marco. I mean, this is a problem that's plagued Park Geun-hye ever since she came into the political sphere, you know, over a decade ago, that she's a bit of an ice queen, that she can't relate to the ordinary person. She did seem genuinely choked up when she was saying the names of some of the heroes from the day that the ship sank, including a crew member who helped give life preservers to some of the students on board to make sure they got off before she did and died. But still, despite the tears, many people here still don't buy it.
What is the cultural context for this kind of public self-shaming and contrition?
Ever since the Sewol ferry sank over a month ago, her approval rating has plunged. And that's in part due to the perception that her administration, and including the Coast Guard and other rescue officials, botched the whole attempt from the start. So it's not uncommon in South Korean politics or in business culture that the person at the top, whether it's the CEO or in this case the president, takes full responsibility for whatever went wrong.
Is there consensus that the Coast Guard in South Korea just did not do what it needed to do?
I think there was a lot of frustration with the Coast Guard's response. Not enough personnel was dispatched initially. However, the reaction so far to President Park's apology really has not been so good. Even the families of the victims held a press conference. One father basically said, has the president already given up hope in trying to find the other dozen or so bodies still unaccounted for by slamming the Coast Guard like this? Is this going to cause the divers who are on the scene now to lose morale and give up the search for those still missing? So I don't think that her decision to disband the Coast Guard is going over very well here.
It seems kind of paradoxical to me. I mean, if you want to ensure ferry safety, why disband the Coast Guard? I mean, what's going to take its place to do the job of ensuring safety on ferry boats?
President Park Geun-hye says the responsibilities are going to be split up. The investigative roles will be handed over to the National Police Agency, and she plans to open up a new government agency, one that's tasked with handling emergency situations like the Sewol ferry sinking. However, the Coast Guard did a lot more than just respond to emergency situations. Some of the biggest roles they've played in the past, chasing away Chinese fishermen that have encroached into South Korean waters. So I think there's concern that by, you know, disbanding the Coast Guard, it's going to leave holes in other places now that they took care of.
Let's contrast for a moment the two Koreas, South and North, because a building in North Korea under construction in the capital, Pyongyang, collapsed last week. This was announced yesterday, and the state news agency reported Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, quote, sat up all night feeling painful after being told about the accident, end quote. I'm just wondering, the different reactions to tragedies in these two Koreas, what strikes you?
Well, North Korea has been critical of President Park's response from the very start. A statement today in North Korean media says that she deserves to be hacked to death because of her insincere apology. Of course, North Korea made this announcement almost a week after this building collapsed. They have not admitted to any fatalities, although some reports here in South Korea say that perhaps hundreds died in this disaster. North Korea is going to try to do whatever it can to show that Kim Jong-un is more sincere than President Park Geun-hye.
And that's how the propaganda machine rolls on both sides of the DMZ. Reporter Jason Strother in Seoul, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Okay, I don't follow NASCAR, don't follow Formula One, but you got to give credit where credit's due. Jack Brabham, winner of 3 Formula One titles, has died at the age of 88. And this is big, whether you're a fan or not. Brabham was from Australia, but made his name as a race car driver in Britain. In 1959, he famously pushed his car to victory after running out of gas on the last lap. Damian Smith, the editor of Motorsport magazine, told me more about why Jack Brabham's death is a huge loss for the racing community.
In Formula One terms, Jack Brabham was really a colossus of our sport. 3 Formula One world titles as a driver, but beyond that, he was also the first driver to win in a car of his own name. In 1966, he built a Brabham in which he won the World Championship, which had never been done before and hasn't been done since and probably never will be. He was also the driver, the first win in a racing car, Formula One car, with the engine behind him. So he had a unique place in the sport's history.
Yeah, so building your own Formula One race car, I mean, why do you see that as such a now, always, and forever thing? It's nobody will ever do it again.
Because so few people have done it, really. The list of drivers who became race car constructors is very short. And he did it at a time when he was kind of frustrated at where he was with the team he was with, and he could see going no further with them. So he decided to take his own destiny into his own hands, built his own team, and in 66, the year he won his third title, there'd been a change in the regulations, and he made most of that and came out of the blocks faster than the opposition and indeed secured that world title. A year later, his teammate Denny Holm did the same. So, you know, 2 titles for the brand new Brabham team was quite something back then, and it's still something that we admire now, all these years later.
He was an Aussie, right?
That's right. He was from Australia and had quite a hard upbringing in Australia and came over to Europe basically to make his motor racing fortune in the 50s. The UK was the place to be at that time for anyone coming from so far away, really, to forge a career. And he turned up in the UK pretty much with nothing and built a reputation for engineering, mechanical sympathy, and also as a talented driver.
Did you ever meet him, Damien?
I was lucky enough to meet him a couple of times. We had an awards ceremony about 6 or 7 years ago, and I managed to get Sir Jack and his wife, Lady Margaret, over to the UK for the ceremony, and I was sat next to him at dinner. He was famously deaf, so conversation was very difficult, even with his hearing aid. But when he came down off the stage, he came straight over to me and shook my hand and looked me straight in the eye, and I just got a little glimpse of the tough guy that he'd always been back in the 50s and 60s, and that was a real pleasure for me.
Where did the deafness come from, as if I kind of didn't know?
Yeah, you guessed it. It's from the racing cars. So with very little silencing in those days, and the engines right behind his head, had no choice but to listen to those engines sing. And over the years, it did affect his hearing. So yeah, he was a lot of the drivers from that era do have hearing problems, and Jack famously had the worst, I think.
So, Damien, how do you think Sir Jack Brabham will be remembered?
He will be remembered as a great pioneer of the sport, a groundbreaking guy with a lot of initiative. He'll also be remembered as one of the toughest drivers. He had a great reputation on the circuit as being hard but fair, and commanded great respect among his rivals. This is a huge day for motor racing to lose Sir Jack Brabham, and he'll be fondly remembered by all who knew him.
Will Motorsport magazine be doing kind of a special issue?
Yes, actually, we're just finishing our 90th anniversary issue today, but our next issue after this one, we'll do a Jack Brabham tribute because, as I say, he's such an important figure in our sport that we'd be remiss of us to not do a lot on the man.
Damien Smith, editor of Motorsport magazine, thank you.
Thank you.
Still ahead, yo-yo-yo, 3 times the Russian letter that no one there is neutral about on the world from PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI and supported by Medtronic, helping build more resilient communities by supporting the American Red Cross so it can be ready to provide assistance whenever and wherever disasters occur. Learn how you can make a difference at AmericanRedCross.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The worst floods in more than a century. That's what many residents of Serbia, Croatia, and Bosnia are dealing with right now. The death toll after nearly a week of heavy rain and swollen rivers has risen to at least 35 people. In Bosnia alone, officials say up to 1 million people have been affected. As if all of that weren't bad enough, mudslides and floodwaters have also disturbed thousands of landmines left over from the war in Bosnia in the early 90s. Ahdin Orhovac is with the Bosnia Mine Action Center in Sarajevo. He's very concerned about that.
We can compare these days as the days after the war with the same consequences. No infrastructure, no electricity, no water, and more minefields.
Right. Well, this is a natural disaster, but it's kind of like a deja vu to the war in Bosnia. You've got these landmines now kind of floating up in the river. Can you just break down for us how many landmines were planted during Bosnia's war from 92 to 95, and how many unexploded mines remain today?
Okay. Immediately after the war, it was 2 million unexploded mines and unexploded ordnances. 19 years we are dealing with this problem. The last assessment is about 120,000 pieces of mines and UXOs. So generally, the problem is reduced drastically, but still it is a danger for many, many communities. Let me say that in this year, there were 8 mine accidents. But now, after this disaster, flooding is more complicating the whole situation.
Tell us how it's complicating the situation.
The main problem in Bosnia and all other countries, there are 90 countries in the world faced with mine action, is how to found the mine. If we know where the mine is, it's a simple job to destroy it, but we are searching. So now it is more complicated because all what we clear now is disturbed. Now we have to create new procedures how to found mines, especially in the landslide areas, and we have to react immediately. The time is essential.
So these mines that were moved by these floodwaters, do you have anybody who's been kind of reporting back to you that they have seen them?
Yes, we have reports, but also we have experience. 5 years ago, River Sava and River Streča, they were also flooded, and then we understood and realized that mines are moving with these conditions, that some people founded some unexploded ordnances around their houses after the flood receding.
I don't know much about the engineering of a mine, but doesn't it require some kind of detonation? And if it's been submerged in water, is it still effective?
You can activate it only with a touch. So our main message to the population, rescue teams, don't touch anything. Please don't touch it.
Well, we are thinking of you through these floods and this added challenge of these unexploded mines from the Bosnian War in the early 90s. Ahdin Orhovac, Deputy Director of the Bosnia Mine Action Center, speaking with us from Sarajevo. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Whenever there are terrible floods these days, like the ones in the Balkans, the question on many people's minds is this climate change at work? I put that question today to one of the country's leading climate researchers, Kevin Trenberth of the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado.
I think there's a climate change influence. The environment in which all of these storms occur now is somewhat moister. The air is a little bit warmer. It can hold more moisture. And one of the results is increasing heavy rains that lead to floods.
And so just break it down real simply for me, the basic physics. Why does a warmer atmosphere mean more rainfall?
So firstly, the oceans are warmer than they used to be. They're about 0.6 degrees Celsius warmer now than they were, say, before about the 1970s. And the air above it is warmer. That air can hold more moisture. And the rule of thumb is that the air holds about 7% more moisture for 1 degree Celsius increase in temperature. And then that gets brought onto land. And in the case of the Balkans region, it was coming directly out of the Mediterranean.
And why a few heavy concentrated downpours? Why not just a little more rain everywhere around the planet?
Well, this relates very much to weather systems. The overall moisture gets concentrated through fronts and what meteorologists are increasingly calling atmospheric rivers. And then when it makes landfall, or this river gets piped up into a particular region, and then it encounters mountains in particular, it gets dumped down and gets concentrated even further. So small differences naturally get concentrated by the nature of the weather events and also by the nature of the runoff in river valleys and so on.
Mm. And there have been recent extreme rainfalls and floods in the last few weeks in Florida, 15 plus inches, it's a record, and also in Afghanistan on the other side of the world, where rains and flooding led to that awful mudslide that buried thousands of villagers. Is the same dynamic going on in Florida and Afghanistan?
I think probably for the most part, I would like to add one more. Actually, my hometown of Christchurch, New Zealand, had major flooding back in March and April. And so it's happening in different places, but the common element is that the air that's flowing into these weather systems is moister than it used to be. Climate change just makes all of the weather events a little more extreme than they otherwise would be.
So if we know that climate change is pushing this more and more, these big kind of destructive weather events around the globe, are we getting any closer to being able to predict where these things are concentrated so we can start planning for them?
Well, that is difficult. Just how these combination of circumstances, where they come together, it is much more difficult. Now, there are certain places, like at the moment, one of the extremes is the major drought in California, and California is prone to these kind of things. We know that in floodplains, people are much more vulnerable. I think this is certainly the case in the Balkans, that part of the main areas that were devastated were almost certainly in a floodplain. So the past may be a good guide as to where the places are more vulnerable, certainly, but increasing heavy rains are fairly universal around the world in places where we have good records. We're just seeing that, when it rains, it pours increasingly, and the planning needs to take that into account.
Kevin Trenberth of the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, thank you.
You're most welcome.
A quick note about the world before we take a break. Over the last few months, we've aired a series on pregnancy and childbirth around the world. We call it The Ninth Month. Now the world is partnering with the Forum at the Harvard School of Public Health to continue the conversation. Log on to Facebook at 11 a.m. Eastern tomorrow for a chat about the cultural implications of delaying pregnancy with social policy professor Allison Earle and bioethicist Glenn Cohen. That's at our Ninth Month Facebook group. Just go to Facebook and search for Ninth Month. This is The World from PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Yoa. It's a letter in the Russian alphabet. You won't find it in most official Russian documents, but it's got plenty of fans.
My guess is that the letter is so popular because a very obscene word begins with this letter. That's probably the principal reason.
Why Russians are divided over the status of one letter, just ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, helping build more resilient communities by supporting the American Red Cross so it can be ready to provide assistance whenever and wherever disasters occur. Learn how you can make a difference at AmericanRedCross.org. And from TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen, available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. More than 100 ninth graders took an exam today. You might ask, what's the big deal with that? I mean, lots of high school kids are doing that this time of year, except these ninth graders happen to be Palestinians, living in the besieged Yarmouk refugee camp outside Damascus, Syria. In other words, they're taking a test in the middle of a civil war. You might have seen the now iconic images of Yarmouk's collapsed buildings and the dense crowds there waiting for a food distribution recently. But today, Yarmouk residents celebrated a small victory. After intense negotiations, about 120 students were able to board buses that drove them past barricades and to a safe location to take their end-of-year exam. The BBC's Lise Doucette took the journey with them.
the students had to make their way through these corridors, these warren of ruins. And just hours before they came out, we could hear sporadic gunfire and heard reports that even at this 11th hour on the eve of the nationwide exams, after weeks of negotiations, the negotiations were still going on with some of the rebel groups inside the camp to ensure safe passage. Nobody wanted to see any of the students being shot. And the students themselves, you have to admire these students, so determined not to lose another year of school, that they were willing to come out with those conditions.
Right. How hard was it for them to study for exams while they were in Yarmouk?
It must have been incredibly difficult. I mean, just take a few of the stories of the boys and girls that we spoke to. All of the students said that they were eating local grasses cooked with spices and water, if water could be found. And 16-year-old Mohammed told me how he left for school one day and he came back to find that a rocket had hit his house. It killed his mother, it killed his two sisters, and it injured two of the others. And then he pauses and he says, "It's not a life, but thank God we're alive." Yeah. So, you know, if any students are listening at this and complaining at this time of year that they have to study so hard for their exams, just spare a thought for the students of Yarmouk who will take these kind of risks to ensure that they don't miss these crucial tests.
Well, exactly. And students here in the United States and many other parts of the world know what it's like to take a test in a community. And I'd like our listeners to hear some sound now. This is of Yuli's on the bus with these students.
Just listen to the ruckus on this school bus. Of course, there are school buses the world over, but this one is completely different. These boys from Yarmouk have been living under siege for months and months. They're expressing their emotion and they're looking out the windows, trying to remember the streets they haven't seen for so many months. Now we've just driven up to the shelter where the students will stay, and families have gathered here too. They're taking pictures, they're waving. Are you friends or sisters?
Friends.
And how long has it been since you've seen each other?
A year and a half.
And you're crying tears of happiness. You're happy to be out?
Alhamdulillah.
Was it hard inside?
So I just came out. My father, mother, brother and sister, my grandparents are inside. It's very difficult. It's very hard, the life inside, no food. I don't want to come back.
So this young woman has been living under siege in Yarmouk, trying to study at the same time. How is it that she and her relatives and neighbors were trapped inside their neighborhoods? What was their situation?
Well, this is what it's like when you live under siege, that you cannot come and go as you please. You are trapped inside. And some of the students told us that they were going to go back, as they're expected to, because all of their relatives, mother, father, brother and sister, were still inside Yarmouk. So they wanted to go back to be with their families, no matter how difficult and desperate the conditions are. There was one man, Khalid, who you just have to smile to see him. He was grinning from ear to ear. He was wearing this jaunty black cap and a big mustache. And his daughter went flying into his arms. He was hugging her. He hadn't seen her for 10 months. He was stuck outside the camp. And when I said to him, "How happy are you?" He said, "I am so happy I could spread my happiness all around the world."
Wow, I love it. Who determines actually who gets to leave the camp and who stays?
It wasn't a done deal. Some of the groups didn't want the students to leave. There had been a shooting incident at the camp a few days earlier. One official with one of the Palestinian groups had been killed. Another had been injured. And so they said, "Right, we're not letting the students out." So we heard that 300 students were waiting to come out. In the end, there were only 120 who came, who decided to take the journey. We were told there was the 9th grade test and the 12th grade test that were being set. And so it was those students who wanted to write those exams. And it was basically the teenagers. Those are the ones who were allowed to leave.
And these 100 or so, will they have to go back now?
They're supposed to go back. And we were surprised that they would let them out because, of course, boys of 14, 15, 16, 17, they're old enough to hold a gun. They're still a fighting age, as terrible a marker as that is in this war. But the whether or not some of them will be able to slip away, certainly seeing some of the relatives who met them and took their young relatives into their clutches, I thought they're never going to let them go now. The exams take place over a period of 2 weeks. And so we'll have to see just how long, whether or not they are willing to risk it.
The BBC's Lise Doucette speaking to us about her recent trip to Damascus. Lise, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
A 2-year battle for the Syrian city of Homs came to an end earlier this month with the evacuation of the last rebel defenders. Now residents are emerging from their shelters to see what's left of their homes. Among them are Sumer Dagestani's relatives. Dagestani works for the BBC Arabic service in London, but he has grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins in Homs, and he spent every summer visiting there as a kid. Then came the war. Dagestani says it has not been easy to communicate with his extended family.
Most of the telephone lines been cut. Sometimes you can get through, but we managed to get in touch, mostly through the internet. It's awful because, I mean, I sit in the newsroom and I receive all the news about the bombardment and shelling and explosions that's been happening in the city for the last 2 years. So whenever I hear anything, I just ring them and it was like, are you all right? I was like, yeah, it's a few meters, it's that street, it happened there. A shell landed on whatever a relative's house, and it's been really stressful times, I would say.
But yeah, for them and for you.
For them and for me. I mean, you know, I'm away. I feel helpless. I can't do anything. I'm always worried. But when I hear them over the phone, I mean, you know, they're coping. They tell me, no, it's all right. Don't over worry. We're doing fine.
But some of them were wounded, I gather.
Yeah, my aunt and her daughter, so my cousin, they were both in a vegetables market, not really far away from my grandparents' house. And then a shell landed on the market, and they both were injured. They were taken to the hospital. My mom called me, and she told me what happened. I called them, and then my little cousin, who's 7 years old, she picked up the phone, and she started telling me what happened. She was like, yeah, we were there, and I was injured, and then they took us to the hospital, and then had a little wound, and I had 7 stitches. And I was like, so how are you? And she was like, yeah, I'm okay. It's
all very
not a big
of
deal.
Fact.
It's not a big deal. And, you know, I'm almost in tears. And I was like, are you all right? And I was, yeah. And she was like, yeah, very strong little girl. And it's just awful that these people, my relatives, a child would have to go through this. But they're resilient. They are.
Were they living in the old city of Homs?
My aunt, she lives not far away from the old city. After the rebels left the city, she went back to her house. There's two shells that landed on the house, so there was not much left. Actually, she only went there to find if she can find some photos, because when she fled the house, she left everything behind. She went back, everything was taken, but she was able to get some photos for her and her family and her boys, 3 little boys, and she was extremely happy. My other cousin actually went to his house, and there was nothing left. He was able to find a photo of his mom and dad when they were on their honeymoon. And he was thrilled to find this.
Wow. That was just in the rubble, just kind of like lying there in the dirt?
Yeah. Just between the dirt. So you just go and search the dirt, trying to find anything.
Is it mostly just those kind of sentimental pieces from the past that your family wants to keep? I mean, they're not obviously going to find, I don't know, furniture or anything, or do they?
No, there's no furniture. There's no nothing. Everything was taken. Everything.
So, I mean, now what? Because, I mean, Homs has been so brutally destroyed and devastated. Does it really have the same meaning as a city for your family? I mean, will they stay there? What happens next?
I think it does. I mean, most of them are devastated of what's happened. They felt that after 2 years, they paid an extraordinary price for what happened, and they feel it was for nothing, because at the end, what happened? The government is controlling the city again, and the rebels left, and they feel that price was for nothing. They lost everything. So they feel kind of defeated, but they still feel it's their city, and they strongly love this city, and they feel that they're going to rebuild it again. But now they just kind of just feel that there's a bit of relief, like, well, we just have some time to rest, you know, at least there's no fighting, there's no bombardment, there's no shelling, and we just have some time to rest.
Sumer, I would imagine that at some point you're going to go back to Homs, you're going to visit, but I'm just wondering, is it something you want to do kind of immediately to kind of get the full scope of what happened to the city of your families, or is it something that you're really kind of hesitant about?
I'm really scared, actually, to go back. I mean, I've seen all the images from the city, and it's a city I can't recognize anymore. I mean, I'm trying to draw a map of the city in my mind, and I just can't. I just see all this destruction. I mean, most of the city has been flattened. I do want to go back. I want to go back to visit the places where I grew up, where I played when I was a little kid, to visit my grandma's grave. I do want to go back. I'm really scared. I don't know. I don't think I want to do it now. But at some point, I do want to go back.
Sumer Dagestani, a producer with the BBC's Arabic service in London. His family is from Homs. Sumer, great to speak with you. Thanks for your thoughts.
Thank you.
In a war zone, like Homs or almost anywhere in Syria, it's often hard to tell friend from foe. Just ask reporter Anthony Lloyd and photographer Jack Hill. They work for The Times, the one in London, and they were captured on their way back to Turkey from a three-day trip to Aleppo in Syria.
There was a very powerful black four-wheel drive ahead of us, moving slowly, and a camouflaged arm came out the window and waved us down. It was very obvious that he was then going to run us off the road, so we stopped. Four guys bowled out of that vehicle, armed, very aggressive, shouting out of the car at gunpoint.
That's Anthony Lloyd relating his experience to the BBC from his hospital bed once he got out of Syria. Lloyd and Hill were captured, along with their Syrian security guard and fixer, Mahmoud.
They took us to an agricultural building of some sort just outside the town of Azaz, which was probably only 2 or 3 minutes away. There we were taken downstairs into a sort of basement, hooded, plasticuffed hands together, and then later fully blindfolded too.
At one point, Mahmoud, his Syrian fixer, managed to wriggle free from his cuffs. He and Hill made a run for it and yelled at Lloyd to take off as well. He ran up the stairs and began to escape across the rooftops. That's when he learned he wasn't involved in some random kidnapping.
I looked down and I could see Jack Hill being beaten by Hakim, who until that morning had been our host and someone we'd known for a long time over a 2.5 year period. And at that moment, you know, it was an awful realization that in fact the one person in his group we thought might have been coming to look for us to help us were in fact our abductors.
Even worse, Lloyd says, was when he was caught, he confronted Hakim.
I was dragged out into the street and I was bleeding. And Hakim walked up. I said to him, I thought you were our friend. And he pulled out his gun and shot me twice in the ankle, deliberately to cripple me. And after that, followed a very protracted beating in the street and in the back of the car.
Eventually, Lloyd says, for some reason, the men decided to take him to a field clinic.
And as the balance of the ratio of people in the room between doctors and fighters changed, so the mood in the room changed, and then the doctors started looking at me saying, you are safe now and nothing is going to happen to you. And then a very tall, powerfully built commander from the Islamic Front walked in and said, why is this man in manacles, naked and bleeding on a gurney? Cut him loose and set him free.
Journalist Anthony Lloyd with The Times of London. He's covered conflicts in Kosovo, Sierra Leone, Afghanistan, Iraq, and recently this challenging assignment in Syria. You're listening to The World on PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. More news today on the Antarctic ice cap, and once again, I'm afraid it's not good news. A new report from the European Space Agency's Cryosat program says Antarctica is losing ice twice as fast as it was just 4 years ago. That's a rate of 160 billion tons of ice melting into the sea every year. Here's more from our colleague at the BBC Science Unit, Jonathan Amos.
The white continent, surrounded by the giant Southern Ocean, has been somewhat insulated from the decades of warming that have affected the rest of the planet. But it's clear Antarctica is not immune, especially at its margins where deep warm waters are now melting some of its biggest glaciers. Cryosat has watched the ice sheet as a whole lose height by an average of 2 centimetres a year. When satellites were last used to assess the continent 4 years ago, they could see 80 billion tons of ice being lost annually to the ocean. The melt figure has now doubled. The major concern is West Antarctica, where the US Space Agency concluded last week that some very profound changes are now underway. 6 colossal glaciers there are in what scientists regard as an unstoppable retreat. Their complete destruction is likely to take several centuries, but they will add more than a metre to global sea levels, with all of the consequences that has for low-lying coastal cities around the world.
The BBC's Jonathan Amos, and a warning, it had seemed, for many cities, including us, right here in Boston. Finally today, some Russian language news for you. Russian ultranationalist politician Vladimir Zhirinovsky recently announced his opposition to one letter in Russia's Cyrillic alphabet. He wants to get rid of the vowel uye. He calls it a nasty Asiatic letter and the reason they don't like us in Europe. Zhirinovsky's call is not likely to be heeded, but it's the latest example of something that has happened a lot in Russia, powerful people trying to dictate changes in the Russian alphabet. Our friend Alina Simone has a story of another Russian letter that's found itself under a different sort of attack.
The most controversial letter in the Russian alphabet is actually the letter Yo. Fans of the letter call themselves Yofikators. They even have a theme song set to the music of Russian rock icon Viktor Tsoi. Why does the letter have a fan club? Because some people think Yo has to go.
It really never took off as an independent letter. It has always remained sort of the shady companion of the letter Ye.
That's Yaroslav Gorbachev, professor of Slavic linguistics at the University of Chicago, explaining that Yo's shaky status has to do with it being a relatively late addition to the Russian alphabet, dropped in at the end of the 1700s. Yo is really the Cyrillic letter Ye, which looks just like the English letter E, only with a diacritic, that is, two dots on top. Confused? Well, trust me, you're even more confused when natives casually omit those two dots, turning a name like Gorbachev into Gorbachev. But Russians have only gotten lazy about dotting their Yos since the 1950s. Before that, the letter, and the very non-Western nature of the alphabet, had a powerful backer. Joseph Stalin.
He signed that document in 1930. Actually, it was a secret document. It was not to be published. That said, lay off Latinization, lay off Romanization of the Russian language. And he also decreed that Yo be put to use every time it's there in the pronunciation.
For the 3% of Russians whose names contain Yo, not having Stalin around anymore to enforce a standard protocol is causing massive bureaucratic headaches. People have been denied passports and had their citizenship revoked. They've been unable to legally divorce and prove their children are theirs, all because of Ye-Yo discrepancies on official documents. But unlike Stalin, Russia's current strongman is remaining silent on the issue.
Probably what's happening when those problems arise is super eager local bureaucrats who want to be holier than the Pope. I don't think Putin is behind this. He probably doesn't care about the alphabet, would be my guess.
Of course, getting rid of Yo would bring Russian one step closer to our alphabet. East versus West, the linguistic tug of war has been going on for centuries. Russia's dual impulse to be embraced by the West while remaining distinctly Slavic is literally etched into the alphabet, starting with legendary font designer Peter the Great.
He was out to westernize the country. He had realized how far behind Russia had fallen in terms of education, in terms of technology, and all these things. And he literally sat down and picked out characters that looked more Roman than Cyrillic.
The Russian alphabet was adapted from Greek, a radically different language, leaving a lot of extra wood to chop. But when Peter axed redundant letters, he was denounced as the Antichrist by religious conservatives, who accused him of changing the very meaning of the Bible. The most controversial modernization actually took decades to implement, proposed by the last Tsar and finally rammed through by the Bolsheviks in 1917. It incensed language snoots, you know, the kind of people who view linguistic misdemeanors as crimes against humanity. They felt Russian was being reduced to the 20th century equivalent of chat speak.
People would say, oh, we saw these things on fences and in the bathrooms. Yeah.
In 2005, the city of Ulyanovsk, birthplace of that most famous of Bolsheviks, Lenin himself, unveiled a monument to Yo, in honor of the local historian who first popularized the rogue letter. But that monument triggered protests too, which brings us to the other reason Russians love Yo.
My guess is that the letter is so popular because a very obscene word begins with this letter. And Russians, you know, we like крепкое слово, you know, a curse word. So people are amused by having this letter around, and there may be other reasons, but that's probably the principal reason.
Given that Vladimir Putin recently passed a law banning the use of curse words in Russian films, plays, and print media, one can only wonder, will Yo end up a victim of modernity or propriety? Or maybe Russia will end up keeping Yo and keeping it weird. For the world, this is Alina Simone.
We've got lots of other stories on how languages are changing at our website. Just go to pri.org/language. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Буква наша ё затерта так, что ё-моё, поставим точки, будем точки охранять.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, the Annenberg Foundation, by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the Ford Foundation, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org, and the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.